KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
Cleveland Heights.
I live in Adams Point.
West Oakland.
I live in San Leandro now.
Up Beach.
Coming up, we'll hear how a San Francisco mural introduces Bay Area residents to Palestinian culture and realities.
You know, and I think the wall is an important one, you know, because of its connection to, you know, what's happening here on the border in America.
Then Oakland mayoral candidate Cedric Troop wants to bridge economic class divisions.
In Oakland right now, it's becoming where it was one large community. Now it's becoming a community of the have and have-nots.
And a Navy vet remembers when he first came to prison 40 years ago.
When I walked down the yard that first day, it was one of the most intimidating feelings I've ever experienced in my life.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is next. The Bay Area is known for its mural art. Vibrant colors, intricate details, and a variety of styles tell the stories of diverse communities. This summer, a new mural in San Francisco went up. It's called Humanity is Key and tells the story of an artist's homeland, Palestine. KALW's Mira Nabulsi has the story behind the artwork.
In the Mission District by the 101 at San Francisco's Upper Market area, a mural covers three of the four sides of a building in the quiet Elgin Park neighborhood. Completing the mural took about 6 months. The artist, Chris Rosales, shows me around the building and explains the process of how it all came together.
I mean, we didn't use projectors. I didn't use any projectors or anything like that. I just measured out the building. And then like on a piece of paper, and then just figured out where things should be, you know, just learn the wall. It's like a mosaic in a way, like, but it's very different, you know, different style, almost like it's not proportionate. It's not like even. It's very random, you know, but
organic.
Yeah, it's more organic. Yeah. But I like that kind of, you know, what that does. I like what that creates.
Pedestrians walking to Elgin Park from Market Street can't miss a major part of the mural, where Chris depicts Amal, the main character in the mural, a woman wearing a beautiful embroidered dress.
Well, the most intricate part of the piece is the dress. It's her thobe, which is a traditional Palestinian dress.
Thobes are normally handmade. The embroidered patterns, mostly geometric, and designs differ from one area of Palestine to another, forming an identity badge indicating a woman's region. The history of the Palestinian embroidery and thobes can be traced to hundreds, even thousands of years ago. And historically, they told the story of village life and used to also indicate a woman's social status. And in the mural, Amal's off-white dress with dark red patterns was inspired by the traditional thobe of the Ramallah area. That's where Chris's family originally comes from. He says Amal is the spirit of this mural. She's the hero and the hope, a tribute to Palestinian women.
Most of the people I know who are activists and working for Palestine are not to take away from the men, but most of them are women. And so I have to, you know, recognize that and pay homage to it too.
On the mural, Amal is a Palestinian returning to the homeland. She carries an orange in one hand and a key in the other. The orange is a major crop of the coastal area of historic Palestine, where Christians, Muslims, and Jews lived and collaborated to maintain the beautiful orchards for generations. As for the key...
The key represents the right of return. Yeah, for people's homes that they left or were kicked out of in 1948. And she's like handing the key to one of the kids that's climbing over, basically telling them, you know, let's go back home, you know, let's go.
A central element of the mural stretching across the building is the image of a tall gray wall cutting through farmland, representing what the Israeli government calls the security fence or barrier, and what Palestinians call the apartheid wall. Israel began building the wall in 2002. It's projected to extend over 800 kilometers, that's about 500 miles, cutting through Palestinian land. Chris says this wall is one of the most striking images of life in present-day Palestine.
I have had to put the wall on the building because I feel like it's the most important visual thing that people can pick up from the situation in Palestine and show, like, you know, the degree of the situation, you know. So like, people don't talk about it a lot. It gets, like, swept under the rug. They're talking about everything else, but, you know, and yeah, it's just another thing that we have to call out.
Chris says he came up with the idea for the wall after discussing it with Ron Dudum, the owner of the building, whose family also came to the U.S. from Palestine. They saw the wall as a display of the connection between struggles of communities of color in the U.S. and those in their ancestral land.
You know, because of his connection to, you know, what's happening here on the border in America and this whole thing with Trump and his wall. And then, yeah, I mean, it's an important thing, you know, and the kids, the brown kids, you know, they could be Mexican, they could be Arab, doesn't matter, you know. So, you know, I think it should be able to speak out to everybody.
The kids Chris mentions are depicted on the mural climbing the wall. He says they're yearning for freedom. Above them is a blue sky with Martin Luther King's famous quote, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." Another quote is written on top of an orange sun that shines over farmland. It's in Arabic by Palestinian author Ghassan Kanafani, and it says, "You can't find the sun in a locked room." Although Chris says there is no bad time for speaking out, he still sees the current political moment as an opportunity.
I think there's a new platform for young, you know, kids, children of color, or like people of color in general, to feel like they have a place, or like have like a, can like speak out, because yeah, there's such like a blatant adversary, you know, like Trump makes himself so clear, you know, how he feels.
But he says racism has always been part of his life. Chris grew up between San Francisco and Detroit, Michigan. He recalls moving from Detroit to a predominantly white suburb and coming home one day to find a swastika painted on his family's home. Being Palestinian and an Arab in America meant navigating mostly negative stereotypes.
No matter what, you're going to get stereotyped. If they don't think that, if they're not like sucked in by Fox News and they think that you're like a terrorist, then they're like from the city and they think like you own a liquor store. Or they are, you know, whatever.
Oh, that's actually it. I feel like that's one that we don't hear too much about, maybe.
Yeah.
We hear more about the terrorists.
Yeah.
We hear more about like people getting called sand N-word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the liquor store, that's an interesting one.
Oh, I mean, that's like the famous joke, like why are Arabs so bad at boxing, you know?
I don't know it.
Because when they get hit in the corner, they open up a liquor store.
Yeah, I'm not from here, so I don't know that one.
Chris says his grandparents have had to hide their heritage at times, especially when they first came to the U.S. They would pretend to be from other countries in fear of being judged or harassed. They wouldn't talk politics, and they wanted to leave their traumas and their past experiences under occupation behind. Chris, who is second-generation Palestinian-American, says he considers himself privileged compared to newer immigrants. That's why he finds it necessary for his art to stand up for something.
Being born and raised here, and then like even my parents too, being first generation, my parents are born and raised here too, so in a way it's given me a little bit of a like a open door to feel like to say whatever I want in a way, and I see it as like an advantage, because I know like a lot of my friends who are Arab or Palestinian, either they're first generation themselves, like they came here, or their parents came here, and so for them they kind of like they learn how to be more quiet about, you know, what they were like about their culture, or not be so like outward with it. I think it's because, you know, their parents are worried. They want them to fit in, you know, they don't want them to have trouble. Like they want them to be able to get through life.
Chris's mural art can be found all over San Francisco. He hopes that his way of cultural and political expression will inspire other youth of color to speak out against injustice and for compassion. That's why he called his mural "Humanity is Key," to emphasize that even in the face of violence and injustice, we should never lose our humanity. It's a story of belonging to the Bay, but also to our ancestral homeland. From San Francisco for Cross Currents, I'm Mira Nablusi.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. We'll turn now to local elections, and in the city of Oakland, 10 people are in the race to be mayor. We're talking with all of them, and today it's Cedric Troop. He's a swim coach and designs multimedia systems for his custom integration business. Cedric spoke with KELW's Janae Darden about why he thinks he's the best person to lead Oakland in a new and better direction.
Such a big job. Why do you want to be mayor of Oakland?
I'm a big dude. I can handle the task. It's my city. Disappointed with the way things are, especially for the children. This community gave me a lot. Too much is given, much is required.
Are you originally from Oakland, born and raised?
Oh, 56 years of my life. Yes, ma'am.
What do you think is the biggest issue right now affecting Oakland?
Will to do the right thing.
Expand on that, please.
Well, basically, in Oakland right now, it's becoming where it was one large community. Now it's becoming a community of the have and have-nots. If I got mine, later for the rest. And so we have an administration that's not in touch with the regular citizens of Oakland.
Hasn't it kind of always been an issue of the have and have-nots? Because you have the Oakland Flats and you have the Oakland Hills.
Well, we've always had different, you know, obviously different levels of income. And, you know, it's always said that when you live on the other side of 580, you're doing big things. But the fact of the matter is that there's always been equity in every neighborhood in Oakland. It might have been better and worse in some areas, but there's always been, you know, a sense of community in every area of Oakland. And there hasn't been this stark contrast of poverty now that we see, where people are sleeping on the streets, where people are sleeping underneath your overpasses. We've never really had that in Oakland. And under this current administration, the problem has been exacerbated. It's gotten worse. You can talk to Keith Carson or Nate Miley, and they'll both say that this problem has gotten worse on our watch. And it's because of a disconnect. This community has always provided me with resources as a young person. I used to swim my behind off when I was growing up. You know, Castlemont, Fremont, McClymonds. And unfortunately, you talked about the flats. Those pools that are serving our children in the flats, Castlemont, McClymonds, and Fremont, have been closed over 10 years. So any city government or any school district that doesn't have something as simple as swimming, which is a life resource for our children, I mean, that just doesn't make sense to me. I don't get it. People say, well, you know, people might not understand because if they don't swim, they don't understand. Because if you don't have a relationship with the water, the most powerful force in the universe, you're not going to get it. But people are supposed to swim. We're supposed to be cool with the water.
I know you talk about youth a lot.
You're supposed to look out for the babies, and shame on us if we don't. And we're not looking out for little babies right now. We got girls out on, you say international, we got girls out on East 14th prostituting themselves at 15, 16 years old. Where's the van of grandmamas and them who going to come and start regulating on them little girls?
So what about the girls that have been forced onto the street? What are you going to do about the pimps that are putting the girls on the street, the child predators that are putting them on the street?
Well, obviously, no. There's a whole big, you know, culture of this sex trafficking thing that goes deep. So the city of Oakland has a number of different ails against it, up against right now. We have to do an audit on every aspect of business in the city of Oakland, from our school district to our city government. We are not using the funds that we get on a state and local level efficiently. There's a lot of mismanagement of funds that's costing us a lot of money. And as a result, we're suffering. We still have the police oversight that's been going on for umpteen years now. We're not taking advantage of federal funds that are on the table for our youth. We just missed out on $10 million a few years ago for our summer youth employment. And then we'll turn around and say, well, what's wrong with these youth when they get on the BART train and tell you to give me all your valuables?
People of all ages, young, old, middle-aged, are sleeping on the streets. And studies I've read, most of them are people who are from Oakland, lived in Oakland for a long time.
So we want to get people off the streets, as simple as that. There are a number of different solutions out there that are working, okay, that we have to employ here in Oakland. From green spaces, if people want to sleep in their tents, we have green spaces available for them with public facilities, showers and laundry and, you know, bathroom facilities. We have vacant buildings that we can incorporate the homeless, because some of them have skills that they can incorporate to renovate these buildings and take residency until we come up with more positive solutions. We have an affordable housing crisis that unfortunately the current administration is exacerbating because she's not keeping her commitment to affordable housing. As you can see, we have buildings going up all over Oakland, and a lot of those are going for market rate prices. We understand that the spot that just opened up on 51st and Broadway has three-bedroom apartments going for $8,000 a month. So our mayor is disconnected. I mean, I think she's doing the best she can under the circumstances with the resources she has, her understanding, but she's not connected to what's happening on the ground level, and as a result, the people in Oakland are suffering. Oakland cannot take four more years of Libby Schaaf's management.
As mayor, you have to work for the have-nots, and you got to work for the haves. How do you do that?
Basically, you apply fair equity as much as possible, and you apply integrity and reasoning to decisions that you're making that are affecting people's lives, okay? The city of Oakland's primary source of income is taxes. We have opportunities to increase our revenue as a city. Jacqueline and Square, okay? The Port of Oakland. I mean, you can do something to increase the Jack London tourist attraction, okay? Because unfortunately, we've kind of been, you know.
Jack London used to be hot back in the day. It's starting to come back,
yeah,
but.
It's starting to come back, but we're sleeping on it, man. We could be doing a lot more Jack London Square.
So what is your plan for handling environmental issues in Oakland?
Well, I consider myself an environmentalist. You know, I'm an open water swimmer. So for me, it's important to keep our rivers, lakes, and oceans clean so we can swim in them. And you hold people accountable that aren't doing what they're supposed to do from an environmental perspective. I mean, people feel it's cool to just come to Oakland and dump their trash. That's not cool. And like I said in one of the forums, I mean, we can't kill them. But we need to add a lot more lighting. There are opportunities for us to have solar lightings on the top of the light posts that it would generate, you know, low cost-effective lighting. But lighting will be one thing, and on that lighting pole, you also put a HD camera, and you have a surveillance system that will allow you to do license plate reading, and you hold these people accountable. Beyond that, I do have to kick in the swimming piece, where this is crazy, I know, but we right here at the Oakland Museum, and right across the street is Lake Merritt. In a 2 to 5 year project, I would like to see water recreation at Lake Merritt, where people are swimming and boating and jet skiing and all that kind of stuff at Lake Merritt. I know that's a tough task, and people don't think I'm crazy, but hey, you know what I'm saying? We could do it. I mean,
yeah, there's already some boating there now.
Yeah, but ain't nobody hopping in that water in no bathing suit. You know, we have a lot of opportunity to make Oakland what it used to be.
That's Cedric Troop, a candidate to be the next mayor of Oakland. He spoke with KLW's Janae Darden. If you've got questions for Cedric or any of the other candidates, you can chime in on our Facebook page or contact Janae at Janae, that's J-E-N-E-E, at KLW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. This week, we're playing stories from our new radio program at Solano State Prison in Vacaville called Uncuffed. The men there record interviews and edit them into short pieces that we play for you here on KELW. One of the students in our class, Steve Drown, has been doing time since 1978. In his 40-year journey through California prisons, one way Steve has stayed out of trouble is by doing paperwork. For years, he was a clerk, making records of violent incidents for a prison administrator, or a PA. Steve's classmate, producer Brian Mazza, asked him about how his background before prison helped him survive for so many years inside.
I first saw Steve Drown on a closed-circuit TV program talking about his participation in the prison's successful Shakespeare Theater troupe. This is a man of fit middle age that affected confident self-possession and a steadfast demeanor. But what I can remember most about him was that there was this unmistakable sense of peace emanating from his eyes. After all, he'd spent most of his life in some of the most dangerous prisons in California. There was purpose in his voice, an exuded sense of true love when he spoke of his craft. Where did he find the strength to survive and the acumen to excel? So Steve, you're a son of a doctor, an athlete, college educated, naval veteran, and a golf pro. Did I miss anything?
No, not really. You pretty well covered it.
Did any of these attributes help you make it when you came to prison facing a possible life term?
I think I took from each and every one of them.
just kind of going over the list that you just ran down, my Navy time, structure, discipline, listening to orders, following orders. I got that same thing from my father when I was being raised. He was a stern man, he was a strict man, but we were in a loving household. Lessons I learned on the golf course, integrity, honesty, and looking out for your fellow competitor. All of those things just kind of fit in with how I've viewed my incarceration and how I viewed doing time. One of the things that I had going for me from the military was a strong clerical background. So when I got into prison, I fell back on my clerical expertise.
So 1978, you come to Folsom, Old Folsom.
That's right.
One of the state's, if not the nation's, roughest penitentiaries.
When I walked on the yard that first day, in between all those granite buildings, coming from R&R, going over to one block, it was one of the most intimidating feelings I've ever experienced in my life. I was scared. So I was only at Folsom for maybe 6 months. And then I got to Tracy, immediately walked into the PA clerk's job, and I wound up staying there for over 5 years. My main job as a PA's clerk was to correlate, type, and prepare all the, what they called, incident packages. And those are reports on when they have an incident, if it's a stabbing, a shooting, whatever it is.
So back in those days, the prison gangs were very strong. The inmates ran the asylum, so to speak. A lot of politics, a lot of drugs, a lot of death, and you stayed out of trouble. How'd you do it?
What I was able to stay away from is not being in the corridor when a riot kicked off, not being on the yard when a riot kicked off. Most of the time I was either up at the studio or up at the office working. So in that regard, I was very fortunate.
Back in those days, they called DVI Gladiator School, correct?
Yeah.
In those hallways or long and sectioned off by bars.
Yeah.
And if you get caught in the wrong unit, with the wrong set,
yeah,
you were in some serious trouble.
You could be in some real serious trouble, yeah. I was able to take my abilities and foster them, and I created a skill set that I knew could be used throughout. And at the same time, it would keep me occupied and keep me out of the day-by-day BS that we normally experience in this system.
So it was like you working all the time was a, and what you were doing was like a shield that protected you from.
I'll be very honest, and you hit it right on the nose. It was a protection mechanism. Sometimes the best way to stay out of trouble is just avoid it.
That was Steve Drown speaking with producer Brian Mazza. Both are students in our radio training program at Solano State Prison, which is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. All content is approved by an information officer. You can listen to more stories from Uncuffed at our website, kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to Cross Currents whenever you want. Today's team includes Janae Darden, Joanne DeLuna, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Sarah Coast, Lisa Morehouse, Truk Nguyen, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Eli Wertschafter, and Aliyah Yates. Gabe Graben, Tarek Foda, and James Rollins engineer the show. Shireen Adil is our content manager. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by the OCs from San Francisco. They're playing the Great American Music Hall in their hometown tomorrow night. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.